Welcome, everyone, to the Take Control of Your Health podcast. This is Dr. Mercola bringing you the latest cutting-edge interviews to help you achieve optimal health. You can receive more information by subscribing to my free daily newsletter at mercola.com. Thank you so much for listening. So let's get started with this week's latest program to help you and your family take control of your health. Dr. Mercola helping you take control of your health. And today we were here with Dr. Christy Sutton, who is going to be exploring some of the dangers of excessive iron, because we're commonly taught and told that iron is really important. It is. It is absolutely important, especially if you're a child, young adult. Frequently you're going to need this. And if you don't get it, you're not going to be able to provide essential nutrient to forming your red blood cells and certain proteins in your mitochondria, which are responsible for producing energy. So it is important, but when in excess, it could cause actually quite significant damage. So I understand, Christy, your husband had a genetic anomaly that caused him to have excess iron. And
yes,
that was what captured your interest in it, and you've been studying. So why don't you start your journey from that? And because it's a big practice of big part of your practice at this point, is that correct?
Yes, yes. So, well, my interest in iron definitely has been lifelong, not just because of my husband, but because personally, I have struggled with low iron because...
Oh, you got both ends of the spectrum.
Right. And so I, you know, have Crohn's, celiac, lost part of my small intestine due to Crohn's when I was 16. And then because of that, I have to take a bile sequestrant. So for me, being, you know, a menstruating female that's had a child, low iron has been something that I have been watched very closely for and had to take iron a lot. So like a lot of clinicians, when I came into practice, I seemed to be more hyper-focused on people's problems that were my own problems. So like, I dealt with iron issues, so I wanted to watch my patient's iron levels closely. And then I realized, oh, not everybody is low. A lot of people actually have high iron. And then it wasn't until I was writing my first book, The Genetic Testing, Defining Your Path to a Personalized Health Plan book, where I discovered the hemochromatosis genes. And I realized that my husband had a hemochromatosis gene. And I realized that that was why I kept telling him, oh, you need to go donate blood, because his doctor would order iron labs, a ferritin, CBC, and he would get elevated iron often, high ferritin. He was developing high liver enzymes, and his red blood cells were getting high as well, which is a common issue with people that have too much iron. And so, but his daughter never said anything about it. And eventually he decided, okay, I need to do something about this. And so he went to a gastroenterologist who, because he was trying to figure out why his liver enzymes were high. And I thought it was the high iron, but that was kind of presented to the gastroenterologist and dismissed. So then they went down this whole rabbit hole of misdiagnosing him with autoimmune hepatitis. And then later we went to a hematologist where we figured out he had hereditary hemochromatosis. So it's not something that's particularly difficult to treat. You know, removing blood, diet, supplements, things like that can help. But once I got really savvy about looking for the genes and the labs combined, I realized, oh, this is really an epidemic that is a silent epidemic that is not really being talked about. And I would tell people, you have a problem with high iron. And then they would often go and get a second opinion, and their second opinion would say, you're fine, don't worry about it. Which is a common issue where people are getting high iron labs that should warrant more investigation. And then they're just kind of getting dismissed.
Discounted because they don't know it's not really commonly taught in the medical school curriculum or really understood or recognized as being dangerous.
And there's some dangerous myths. Mm-hmm. So with hereditary hemochromatosis.
Well, let's stop there because you said a bunch, and I just want to address that.
I'm
We'll come
sorry.
back to the no, don't worry. The dangerous myths we'll come back to. So you had mentioned we'll get into the reasons why you'd want to lower someone's iron in a moment, but the therapeutic strategies you recommended were diet, therapeutic phlebotomies, and supplements. So I've been involved with, or was aware of the dangers of iron in the either the early 90s or late 80s. So it's quite a while. And at that time, actually, it was probably as a result of Bill Sardi's work. He made me first aware of it. And interestingly, my dad has, and I both have beta thalassemia, which is a hemolytic anemia that has a high turnover of red blood cells, results in a high turnover of red blood cells. It's 2 months instead of 3 months. And as a result, a lot of that iron is accumulated because of the turnover. So it's real common to have, it's not a hemochromatosis gene, but it results in similar problems in high iron. So as a result, he had, I think, a ferritin close to 1,000,
Oh, wow.
and which is pretty high, of course. I mean, ideally, it should be below 40, I think. We'll talk about the normals. But so I played with some of the supplements. That's the reason for the story is, and specifically, the big one is inositol. Something hexa, you would know. I just don't recall. It's IP6, inositol phosphate. What is the name of it?
IP6, yeah.
Yeah, but there's the chemical name I don't recall. But it's
Inositol
IP.
by P-phosphate, or I'm sorry.
Hexaphosphate, because the hex is a safe. But anyway, it's IP6, and it's speculated it's helpful. It didn't do squat for my dad, nothing. And I rapidly came to the conclusion that the supplements are useless. And perhaps potentially even dangerous because they prevent you from doing what really is helpful, is to removing the iron. And the iron is primarily stored in red blood cells, the vast majority of it. So that's the way to do it. So I'm wondering if there are some supplements I'm unaware of, or why you would mention supplements would be useful.
It's interesting that you jumped to IP6 because that's one that people like to talk about and ask me about. And I did not include it in the supplements in the book because I couldn't find any research to back up all of these claims. And I wasn't willing to experiment on my patients with something that didn't have good research. And so I can't really speak to it. What I can speak to are the things that I have included in the Iron Curse protocols and the supplements. And the most important one, I think, is curcumin. Because
Really?
curcumin, yeah. So there's a handful that I think are very important. But I have seen clinically the curcumin's ability to lower iron, almost to a fault. It's annoying to me because I can't take curcumin for inflammation because it makes me low in iron. But for people that are high in iron or even inflamed with high iron, high ferritin, that's a great place to start because curcumin, which is the extract from turmeric, of course, it binds to iron. So, and then it has all of these other wonderful health promoting properties, like it's so good for your brain, and it actually helps remove excess iron from the brain and the organs, other organs, the heart, liver, spleen. So, unlike other iron chelators that might be used pharmaceutically, it doesn't have all these down possible negative side effects, but it works very effectively. I mean, I've seen this be used in hereditary hemochromatosis patients to lower iron without blood removal because there are a lot of people
That's
that
impressive.
cannot, you have a unique situation. You're kind of more in an iron loading anemia situation where you can get low in red blood cells from the thalassemia, which is why you have to be careful about not removing too much blood, but you still need to be able to pull that iron out. And so that's where curcumin is one of the most valuable things. You can take it with an iron-rich meal, like if you're eating,
I did not
shellfish,
know that.
or red
So,
meat.
and the, I think, as I remember, recall, the only drug that's indicated for removal or lowering iron would be desferoxamine. Is that correct? Or
I
is there,
think
are
there's
there other?
another one, but and they all have specific side effects that
Yeah, they're not
curcumin
good.
doesn't
Curcumin is
have.
much better. Yeah, it's a natural product.
And
Yeah,
it
it really
has all these wonderful
is.
health bonuses. So curcumin's one. I'm happy to go into other
No, that's fine. It's just it's just a curiosity question. It's not really people's bottom line is people should not use the drugs. Stay away from the drugs.
I mean, I'm happy to go into other supplements that I've
Are there others that are binders like curcumin?
well, yeah. Okay, so there's others that are binders. So another one is silymarin,
Oh.
which is an extract from milk thistle, which is very good also for hemochromatosis patients because not only are we lowering iron here, but we're also helping to protect and repair the liver. And it's got other health promoting effects, been shown to be good for sperm because, high iron destroys the testes and the ovaries and the brain. And so I don't think silymarin lowers iron quite as much as curcumin, but it's still a significant way to lower iron. The best way to take these to lower iron is take them with an iron-rich meal. If you want to take them just for medicinal properties but not lower iron, take them away from an iron-rich meal. Other things that help to lower iron.
Just to clarify that, their binding capacity to iron is iron in your gut before it's absorbed, rather than extracting the iron from your tissues, which would be in the red blood cells primarily and the bone
You,
marrow.
I, that's a really good question, and I don't think I can speak to the specifics on that because it seems like it actually is lowering iron out of there's studies that have shown that the curcumin has been able to lower the iron in the brain and the spleen. And so I don't know if it has a way other than just
Well, it might
binding.
be in equilibrium because it's. I know that's true with oxalate crystals. If you can get the dietary intake down to really low, then it's going to come to an equilibrium, essentially come out of the tissues. Because
Right, like if you get it low enough, then it's going to come
right.
out. Yeah, exactly.
I
Yeah,
think that's
but
part of the mechanism.
yeah. Or but can the curcumin also get past the blood-brain barrier and have some other effect there that can help pull the iron out? I don't know. And I don't know how to study
But
that.
it seems to be useful. You notice a decrease in ferritin levels.
It works very well. Now, depending, like some people might need to take more than others. People that have really high iron might need like 3 grams a day, which at some point that can create diarrhea. So you have to look at, other potential limiting factors. Another thing that binds to iron and lowers iron is alpha lipoic acid. So alpha lipoic acid not only lowers iron, but it's also great for protecting the nerves and lowering blood sugar. Which hemochromatosis not only destroys your liver, but it also destroys your pancreas, causing, diabetes, type 1 and type 2 diabetes. It destroys the brain, increasing your risk for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, you name it, bipolar, schizophrenia. So alpha lipoic acid is a nice one for if you want to treat that, higher blood
That's
sugar.
precisely what happened to my father. He developed what's called bronze diabetes from high iron.
Oh, yeah.
He had bronze diabetes. It was like diabetes type 3, which is typically referred to like Alzheimer's diabetes, but it was really type 2 and type 1. He had wound up having to really take insulin. I know it's commonly prescribed for type 2 diabetes. Foolishly prescribed, needlessly. It's the wrong solution. But he really needed it. So, because of the oxidative stress, it damaged the beta cells in the pancreas and he stopped being able to produce his own insulin.
Yeah, and so definitely if you're getting that bronzing color, that's from high iron causing damage to the skin, and then you're getting that extra melanin production from the high iron creating all that damage, and then you get that bronzing effect, which if you lower the iron, then the bronzing effect goes away. And then also the other risk for other skin issues, like skin cancer is a higher risk for people that have high iron as well. Infections, skin infections, or
But
is a high.
let me stop there because I think it's a catalyst, actually, and something. It was a question I wanted to ask you that's related to the skin cancer. Are you familiar with lipofuscin?
With, say that.
Lipofuscin.
No.
It's damaged linoleic acid and it's damaged because it's oxidized by iron and it forms the liver spots is the common name for them. These
Okay.
pigmentations in the skin, it's lipofuscin. It's actually a dermal representation of oxidative damage from high linoleic acid. So the increased risk for skin cancer is not so much from the iron it's only because you have high linoleic acid. And iron is one of the molecules that will absolutely damage those double bonds in linoleic acid, no question. And the sunlight, the combination, it's a combination of the two.
And I wonder, is it ferroptosis that, because are you familiar with ferroptosis? Yeah, so I wonder if the linoleic acid with the iron increases the ferroptosis, which is where you get more lipid peroxides and create this massive amount of oxidative stress.
Yeah, they're a really bad combination, really are. And
Yes.
it's my perception that the high linoleic acid is more of a serious issue, because if it was normalized to ancestral levels of less than 2%, ideally less than 1%, and it's like 25% in most people, 25%. If you had it to normal levels, you could have the higher iron and not get as much damage, hardly at all. I mean, because that's what is damaging, is primarily that fatty acid. It's an overabundance in the body.
Well, I don't know, because you're always going to have cell membranes regardless of the
Yeah,
linoleic
that's where it's
acid
at.
ratio, right? But you're always going to have the cell membranes. And I would be interested to see if cell membranes that have a lower amount of linoleic acid did not create as much ferroptosis. I don't know.
Yeah,
My
they
guess
should,
is they
because
don't.
no, because saturated fat is not predisposes to oxidation.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, if you replace it, and that's the issue. Or even have MUFAs, or monounsaturated fats, like oleic acid. But anyway, it's a tangent. So I think it would be useful that, since you have experience in both, and there's a lot of confusion on this topic, I would appreciate you sharing your journey of learning how to differentiate between the two, the obvious ones, because I've interviewed Morley Robbins a few times on this topic, and he's perceived as an expert in this area, at least self-perceived. Yes. And I think he's a little bit too hyper-focused on that, and he's not really seeing the bigger picture. And that's why I really wanted to talk to you, to get a different perspective than Morley's,
Okay.
because he like sees everything through the world of copper and iron.
Right.
That's it. There's really nothing else.
Yeah. Okay.
That's not accurate. I mean, they're definitely important molecules, but it needs to be in a bigger context. So, because his positioning is that there almost is no such thing as iron deficiency. I mean, it's almost at that extreme. It's like the
Yeah.
ideal ferritin level is zero, which I think is probably not
Dangerous.
like, yes, very dangerous. But
Yeah.
that's what his belief is.
Okay.
And so at some point, but it can, you can have single, I believe you can have single digits ferritin levels and still have excess iron because of
In
copper
your
depletion.
tissues. Yeah,
Yes, in your tissues.
I'm
Yeah,
more than happy to talk about all
what
that.
I would be curious, if you could help us understand and navigate from your perspective how to differentiate between those two entities, because it is a clinical challenge, there's no question. And it's
Yeah.
in some ways it's an advanced clinical challenge, because 98% of physicians wouldn't even understand it's an issue.
Yeah. Okay. So iron deficient anemia versus copper deficient anemia versus iron overload and hereditary hemochromatosis. Do you want me to kind of.
Yeah, and just yeah, that those are the primary thing, those are the primary diagnoses you're seeking to put a marker on it and boldly claim that this is the correct diagnosis.
Okay.
And
Okay.
please understand, this is an advanced perspective, because almost every medical doctor doesn't understand this. They have no clue.
Okay. So, okay. I'd like to start with hereditary hemochromatosis.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll start wherever you like.
Okay. So, when it comes to diagnosing iron issues, it can get very complicated. And the nice thing is that you can always fall back on labs, and you don't really want to just use symptoms to guide you, because if you're using symptoms, then this person is well far down a pathological path that you could have potentially stopped years ago, if not decades before. So the first, if we talk about hereditary hemochromatosis, iron overload, iron deficient anemia, copper deficient anemia, other anemias, hemolytic anemia, like what you deal with. There's different labs that basically you need to know and understand, and genes as well. Mm-hmm. And so the first one I want to discuss is hereditary hemochromatosis. So hereditary hemochromatosis is when you have inherited one of three hemochromatosis genes, which cause you to increase iron absorption by decreasing hepcidin, which hepcidin is this molecule that it's a protein that your liver makes. And if you have this gene, the hemochromatosis gene, you don't make as much hepcidin, and then you absorb more iron. And that can become pathological because over time, it's like you just keep getting more and more and more, and you kind of become this iron hoarder, and your body runs out of places to put it. Because first it wants to put it in the liver, and then the liver overflows, and then it'll go to the next place, whether that's your heart or your pancreas or your brain, pituitary gland, gonads, ovaries, testes, skin. Eventually it will go everywhere because the body has evolved to hold on to as much iron as possible. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of ways to lose iron other than you can lose a small amount through your skin. But mostly iron loss is through menstruation, which is why females tend to be at a lower risk for high iron and a higher risk for low iron because they menstruate every month. And if you have a heavy period, you're going to lose a lot of iron. If you have a light period or no period, you're not going to lose as much. If you are pregnant, you're going to lose a ton of iron. So females are just naturally at a higher risk for having low iron issues. Whereas men are at a higher risk for having high iron issues. Having said that, when you start looking at the hemochromatosis genes, all bets are off because you'll see females that have these hemochromatosis genes that develop high iron, and you'll see men with the hemochromatosis genes that develop high iron as well. They often get diagnosed first. And then if you're really looking closely, which not many people are, you will even see children with the hemochromatosis genes that develop high iron. And I discovered that in my colleague's five-year-old, where hereditary hemochromatosis was causing her to have severe neurological problems. And that was a very difficult thing to get through because the hematologist didn't really want to deal with it. So, okay, that's hereditary hemochromatosis, okay? And when you look at labs, which is really, hereditary hemochromatosis can look very similar to non-hereditary hemochromatosis, which is where you have high iron, but you don't have one of those hemochromatosis genes. So, like for you, you have more of a non-hereditary secondary hemochromatosis because you have that thalassemia issue where your red blood cells are breaking and letting all this iron out, and then you develop high iron with potentially low red blood cells. So, mm-hmm. And that's common with thalassemia. Some people, they don't have a thalassemia gene and they develop high iron without a hemochromatosis gene because they're just eating a lot of iron-rich foods and they're not losing iron through menstruation. This is usually men. Mm-hmm. Okay, so hereditary hemochromatosis on labs. The most important labs that you kind of always have to start with are the full iron panel, which I'll go through that, the CBC, and then always get a comprehensive metabolic panel because you need to have those liver enzymes anytime you're, you know, you can get many more. Like, it's always nice to get a copper and a ceruloplasm and all that. But the reality is that most doctors are not going to be ordering the copper and the ceruloplasm. And we need to not, you know, lose the forest through the trees. And we need to make sure that, if nothing else, we understand that iron panel, CBC, and comprehensive metabolic panel, which has the liver enzymes. So for the full iron panel, that has the ferritin, the TIBC, the UIBC, and the serum iron, and then just the iron saturation. Mm-hmm. So with hereditary hemochromatosis, you develop high ferritin with a high iron saturation. That combination is hereditary hemochromatosis. So over 45% iron saturation and then high ferritin. Now, high...
Yeah, give us your range that you consider high.
Yeah, so high is a relative term because some doctors don't care about ferritin until it's over 1,000. Labs, yeah, that's well outside of lab range, but that's just how misguided some people are. So
I would suggest they're unguided.
Delusional.
Not delusional, they're just not guided. Simple.
They're not guided.
The guides are pretty accurate if you listen to them, but they're just not listening.
Okay, that's fair. That's a fair point. So some labs allow ferritin to go into the 400s or 300s for men. Often for women, the ferritin tops out around 150. I never like ferritin to be over 100.
What's your idea? What's your ideal?
Ideal is relative to depending on the person. So okay. I never like people to be over 100. If
kind of like blood sugar levels.
Blood sugar,
fasting,
you mean
relative? Blood sugar levels.
You mean, like, is it relative there too?
No, I've seen just like you don't want a fasting blood sugar to be over 100.
Correct, exactly, yeah. And in my opinion, and I'll tell you why, you know, as far as the research goes, in my opinion, a ferritin over 100 means you're either inflamed, have high iron, or both. Mm-hmm. And so there are some good studies that I reference in my book that show definitely anything over 200 is pathological. Mm-hmm. The higher you get, the shorter your lifespan by decades. It's not insignificant at all. You're more likely to die of a heart attack. You're more likely to die of cancer. You're just more likely to die at a younger age. Now, there is some more recent research that showed they looked at COVID-related mortality, and they found that a ferritin over 100 was associated with an increased risk for COVID-related mortality. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest with you, I just like nice round numbers, mm-hmm. and I don't like it ever to go above 100. And I feel like 100 is high enough that I'm not like swooping everybody in, but low enough that I'm not leaving stragglers out. Now, if somebody has a ferritin over 100 with an iron saturation that is in the 40s or definitely higher, then I'm highly suspicious of a hemochromatosis gene, and I immediately want to get those hemochromatosis genes tested. And if they have a hemochromatosis gene, then we know why they're high in iron, and we know where this story is going, and it's not going to be a pretty picture, most likely. So then, you know, it's time to refer to a hematologist who is probably not going to take them seriously at that point in time, and talk to them about, you know, how to get iron lower. So
why couldn't you just manage it yourself? Because in most cases, you'll know how to do it better than they will.
I am a chiropractor.
Yeah.
And in the state of Texas, I have to.
Oh, you're required by license to do that.
Right. I can treat musculoskeletal conditions, which hereditary hemochromatosis is a musculoskeletal condition. It causes muscle atrophy, joint pain, you know, serious issues, osteoporosis. However, I am not by my license allowed. I can diagnose all these conditions and I can refer, but I cannot treat. And so I always, you know, to save my license, will refer out. And then I'm ultimately usually disappointed by the advice they got, which I think is dangerous. And then that's ultimately why I spent all this time writing The Iron Curse, because I felt, I realized how many people were being misled and really dismissed about potential health problems that they needed to avoid.
That's
so,
brilliant. Yes.
Okay, so hereditary hemochromatosis, the labs should not go above 45% on iron saturation. And then if you have a hemochromatosis gene, you want to keep that ferritin much lower. A lot of times hematologists like to keep that ferritin below 50. Some even want to keep it in the 30s. So if you have one of those hemochromatosis genes and you've proven that you can go high or on the high end of normal, then you want to keep your ferritin lower to give yourself a buffer towards your danger zone. Whereas if, like myself, if I get my ferritin into the 60s, I'm really ecstatic. I'm not going to do anything to lower that. I feel really good about that.
Yeah. So it's customized for the person. But in the common scenario, which is the hemochromatosis that your husband has and many others who have overload for a variety of reasons, as you'll discuss, what do you think is that? What is the ideal you're targeting for your husband? Is it 30, 20, 25?
So generally you need to get below 50, but In some cases, you have to get into the 30s to get those liver enzymes down to normal. It can take a long time to get the liver enzymes down to normal. And it's interesting because some of these people with really bad hemochromatosis genes, by bad, I mean they inherited two of like the worst ones. They're called C282Y, C282Y. They inherited two of the highest risk genes. These people can jump up very quickly because they're genetically just like excellent at absorbing iron, which at one point in time was this evolutionary advantage.
Yeah, sure.
Not anymore. Well, in some cases, it still is, you know, like when I would love to have a hemochromatosis gene, but sure. I don't. So, okay, so that's hereditary hemochromatosis. With the iron panel, you'll see with high iron, you'll see the TIBC go low, the UIBC go low, the serum iron often goes high, and then that ferritin will go high. You'll often see the liver enzymes go high, and it's common to see the red blood cells, hemoglobin, hematocrit go high, but that doesn't always happen. And these days, so many people are taking testosterone, so you have to kind of always ask, are you on testosterone? Because that can cause those things to go high as well, the red blood cells, hemoglobin, hematocrit.
In the past, I interviewed an expert who didn't really have a medical degree, but he was, I think, part of some hemochromatosis foundation. And he was advocating GGT as the most sensitive enzyme to assess. And I don't think it's part of the normal comprehensive metabolic profile or panel. So it has to be ordered separately. It's an inexpensive test. It's well under $10, like $5 or $6. But have you had experience with that? And
I always get the GGT as a part of the labs that I order. Okay. And occasionally I will see a high GGT when the AST and ALT, which are the other two liver enzymes, are normal. More often than not, I'll see a high ALT or high AST.
Okay.
Usually if they're not drinking alcohol and they just have high iron, you're going to see that high ALT.
Okay.
If there's alcohol involved.
These numbers ideally should be in the teens, not the 20s, right?
Right, right. But, you know, my husband's were well out of range in the 80s and 90s, and his doctor wasn't saying a word to him because I think they just see so many people
Normal. It's normal.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and they always think, oh, you're drinking too much alcohol or whatever. And some people are. That was not our problem. And also then I didn't get into this, but my husband developed a pituitary tumor that was causing him to have high cortisol Cushing's disease. Mm. And ultimately, I think the high iron created a lot of oxidative stress on his pituitary gland.
So rare. Yeah.
Yeah. So he had this ACTH pituitary tumor. And the only reason we diagnosed that early, quote unquote, even though it'd been going on for probably a decade, was that I had been ordering his cortisol and DHEA, and periodically they would jump up and then go back down.
Wow.
And then when the hemochromatosis got properly treated and the DHEA was still high, we were like, why is this happening? So we went to the endocrinologist and I said, I'm worried my husband has Cushing's. And she was like, he doesn't have Cushing's. He doesn't look like somebody with Cushing's. His hemoglobin A1C is normal. You know, anyways, 5 months later, he's having, you know, surgery to remove the pituitary tumor. The reason I say that is because for years he was told, you just need to exercise and lose weight. And it's like, okay, his problem was not exercise. And, you know, he had a pituitary tumor and hemochromatosis. Hemochromatosis was destroying his liver and his brain and, you know, his heart and everything else. And the pituitary tumor was causing him to have high cortisol, which made him look overweight, like he had a beer belly.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just so often these conditions don't even get looked into, this idea that everything's just, you know, well, you need to try harder.
So did he had an MRI and a microadenoma in pituitary?
Yeah. So the MRI, interestingly enough, showed, they said that there was, they saw one, but then when they went in to do surgery, they were like, oh, actually that was a capillary on the MRI. He did have a pituitary tumor, but it was in a different part of the pituitary and it was much bigger than we thought. And the very esteemed neurosurgeon, we now realize, totally botched the surgery, because we had to go back 5 years later, which was just like 6 months ago, for the second surgery, which was a much better experience from a different surgeon that was, you know, younger and you had a better technique. And hopefully that's it. Hopefully they removed it all. But the first surgery did not remove it all. He missed part of it and he knew that. But he, you know, he also caused the cerebral spinal fluid leak. And I think he was just ready to get out of there. Yeah. So the second surgeon, I think, got it all out. That's a whole nother story that, I mean, yeah, if you want to talk about Cushing's another day.
Illustration of the dangers of the medical system.
Yes, I have been living in that. So yeah. I don't mean to digress. I'm happy to go back and we can circle back around to the other diagnoses of, we can talk about low iron.
Sure.
Okay. So as far as, one thing I wanted to say to kind of follow up on the hereditary hemochromatosis versus non-hereditary is really the key is you don't have a hemochromatosis gene, and then you need to make sure, okay, does some, figure out why does this person have high iron? Do they have a thalassemia gene? Are they just eating a lot of iron? And then do they have hemolysis for some unknown reason? So, but that's a non-hereditary hemochromatosis situation. The treatment is basically the same, other than you want to use more of the supplements, really heavy on the supplements to lower iron.
We didn't talk about, was my understanding that the treatment is therapeutic phlebotomy is the first intervention.
Okay. Yeah. So if if you have plenty of red blood cells and hemoglobin, then therapeutic phlebotomy is a wonderful place to start. A lot of times people don't because they either have a thalassemia issue where their red blood cells are getting chewed up too quickly, or they have been really lost so much blood so quickly because their doctors are just trying to get the iron down that they become low in hemoglobin or red blood cells. Mm-hmm. And rather than waiting, you know, for months for that to recover, you could be doing the supplements to lower the iron while you're still.
That makes sense. But yeah. There's another option that you may not be aware of, and it doesn't really require a physician or a physician's license. And because typically therapeutic phlebotomies imply that you're donating your blood, which is 16 ounces of blood. That's a big hit. It's a big hit on most people, especially if you're already anemic. The alternative is to do it more frequently, which is what I do. I was actually doing, 60 cc's, 2 ounces once a week. But then I was just getting too many holes in my veins. So I started doing 120 cc's, which is 4 ounces every 2 weeks. So 8 ounces a month. So a pint every 2 months.
I wonder if you were to do the curcumin and maybe some quercetin, which lowers, quercetin lowers iron absorption. So it increases hepcidin. Mm-hmm. So then you're going to be able to lower iron absorption. You could do some of those supplements, like in the iron curse. You could do
when you take the meal. When you're taking the iron,
right? Or even without, just get them in, and then you might not need to have so much blood removed because you're not absorbing as much iron as you otherwise would be. That might be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, that's an interesting alternative, easy to monitor because I take my blood I've taken my blood pretty much once a month for decades. So a lot of data to look at.
Yeah, try that. Yeah. So then as far as those are the high iron issues. Now, I think next we should probably talk about iron deficient anemia, which is the most common nutritional deficiency in the world. It's very common just because of, and in fact, iron deficient anemia is the reason that the hemochromatosis genes exist and exist in over 30% of the global population that's been tested.
So it's a response to this common nutritional deficiency.
Yes, because low iron has been a historical gauntlet that has killed, you know, countless people from, you know, whether it was blood loss due to an injury or pregnancy, delivery, famines. So the whole reason that Ireland has over 60% of the population with one of these hemochromatosis genes is because of the Irish potato famine. So anyways, this gene that allows you to absorb more iron exists because low iron killed so many people. And evolution was like, okay, we're going to keep that one because that's going to help us have more kids. So iron deficient anemia is a serious issue that, you know, if you are pregnant with low iron, your child is more likely to have a significantly lower IQ, more likely to have ADD, ADHD, serious neurological problems that often do not go away with age. Many kids suffer from low iron because they eat a lot of calcium-rich foods, which calcium binds to iron, and then you get low in the iron. Maybe they're picky eaters, they're growing rapidly. And so many kids are not being checked for their iron levels, and they're being diagnosed with ADHD when their problem is actually just low iron, because if you don't have enough iron, you can't make dopamine. So low iron is a serious issue. And what that looks like on labs, so iron deficient anemia is a different condition from copper deficient anemia, which I'll talk about next. So iron deficient anemia on labs, you're going to be looking at the iron panel, which has the TIBC, and the UIBC will be high. And then that's because the body is trying to get more iron to be mobilized and moved throughout the body. The serum iron will often be low. The iron saturation will often be low. And then that ferritin is ferritin, I think, is usually the first marker to really indicate you're in trouble, and is probably one of the best markers, assuming you're not super inflamed. But ferritin, anybody that has a ferritin below 30, I think they need to be figuring out how to get that iron higher. Now, iron deficient anemia is more complicated in many ways, because the question is, why are you low in iron? And there's so many reasons that you can be low in iron. You know, are you just not eating enough? Are you not absorbing it? I think the most common reasons that people develop low iron is because they have a GI bleed, they have intestinal malabsorption issues, maybe undiagnosed celiac disease. There is a gene that can cause you to be more likely to have low iron. I have that gene, and that gene actually causes you to make more hepcidin so that you absorb less iron. Mm-hmm. But iron deficient anemia, you'll also see on labs low red blood cells sometimes, low hemoglobin, low hematocrit, things like that. Mm-hmm. The MCH might get low, the MCV might get low, things like that. Now, where I know a lot of your viewers and you are interested in is the caveat of, well, copper deficient anemia. And so copper deficient...
Before we go there, and one of the Morley's concerns, just as something to integrate into your answer, is that as you get elderly, 50, 60, 70 and older, you've had a lot of time to absorb this iron, especially those who have iron overload. And you could even, I forget the equation, it's just... He contends that you only need like 5 grams of iron in your body to meet your body's needs, 5,000 milligrams. And many people can have 25,000 milligrams. And I forget the exact amount. It's you can lose about 100 milligrams a month, but that would take many years, decades to remove the excess iron from your body if you were using phlebotomy. And even if you had the optimal binding supplements you recommend, you're not going to, because that's the other issue. You not only have to address it, but you have to address the new iron that's coming in your body, right?
Right.
Yeah. So do you believe that's accurate, that many people as they get older may have 20, 30, 40 grams of excess iron that needs to be removed?
My understanding from what I've read in the research is that 50 grams is the highest reported for a hemochromatosis patient, which these are going to be the people that are the highest.
Yeah.
At some point in time,
how was that determined? You know, was it like a liver biopsy or was it?
I don't know. See, that's a really good question.
Morley had this, and I think it's really good. I never followed up on it. It was a few years ago, but apparently the best tool Because I mean, there is no blood test for it. You're just going to measure, you know, those are blood markers. It's not tissue markers, which is what we're seeking to address. But an MRI has the potential to do this, to actually give you a reading of what your total body ferritin is.
Oh, you mean like an abdominal MRI to like look at your liver?
Well, I think it might be a total body. I don't know. But the data is there. You just have to have the software to interpret the data. And it may be available now, not widely, but I know there were some scientists working on it.
I don't know, because I don't order a lot of total body MRIs on my patients, and most people are not doing that at this point in time, not because it's not clinically relevant, it's just not within the realm of norm, so I can't comment on that. Yeah. At some point in time, around 50 grams, if somebody's up to 50 grams, that, you know, that's fatal. They're going to die. So, and then what is your ferritin at that point in time? Probably 5,000, you know, it's really high.
But do you believe that the ideal is 5,000 milligrams or 5 grams, and that many people have 20, 30, maybe not 50, but 20 or 30 grams?
I think there are many people with undiagnosed hemochromatosis that are in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, the speed that they get come down largely depends on what they're doing, and everybody's kind of doing different things. So it's hard to quantify exactly, you know, how fast that's going to come down. Iron is such an individual thing because there's so many environmental factors. I think, you know, the research shows that the average person has between 2 to 3 grams of iron in their body, like an average adult. I don't know how much iron I have in my body, honestly. I've never done like a total MRI to figure that out.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that that's a conventionally, it may not be, it may just be a research tool at this point, but I know there were some people looking at it, and I don't know, I should follow up and find out if that's been widely adopted, and we'll be able to assert that, I'll ping morally, because that was like 2 years ago, maybe 3 years that we discussed it. And I know they were looking to bring it to market, but it may not be available. So, you know, you'd be well intentioned. you're not good. It's not one of the options on diagnosis.
Right. There's a lot of things I'd love to have diagnostically. I don't have, I'd love to be able to check Hepcidin and Hemosiderin, and, you know, we don't have those either. So we do the best we can with what we have, but you know, the highest I'm aware of that's been documented was 50 grams in a hereditary hemochromatosis patient. And then at that point in time, they died because their body was just done.
Oxidized big time. Yeah.
So, just like did you hear about that Scottish lady that her ferritin was 5,500 and she's like Scottish royal. She's some royal Scottish with 2 hemochromatosis genes, and she was just never diagnosed and died in her 50s from hemochromatosis.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
So are you of Irish ancestry? Just curious.
Yeah.
Yes, because, and you had the inflammatory bowel disease, wasn't it?
I have Crohn's and I have celiac.
It's really common in Irish people.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. What's the prevalence? It seems like it's over 25%, maybe over 50%.
I don't know. I wish I knew. It's gotta be high. I've heard part of that is because Rome never conquered Ireland, but it could also be that the celiac gene just started, you know, at a very early.
Well, there's some reason for it. But, you know, when I was treating patients, if someone was Irish, that was part of the instructions. They couldn't have wheat because there's a high likelihood they wouldn't do well with it.
Yeah. I look a lot at the celiac genes, and most people that have one of those genes has a problem with gluten, and they just don't know it. Once they get off of a gluten-free diet, they often feel better. But but celiac does commonly cause low iron. And because we're not looking at a lot of nutrients commonly in medicine, iron is the first one that often gets diagnosed. But if you're low in iron and you have celiac, you're probably low in everything else too, because you're just not absorbing anything. So that when you're looking at a low iron person, you really have to figure out, you know, the question is why. Are they low because they have undiagnosed celiac? Do they not make enough hydrochloric acid? Do they have a GI bleed? You know, what's going on with their gut? Have they had some part of their bowel removed or done a bypass? There's all these different reasons that people can be low in iron. And you really have to kind of figure out why that is, which is often much a harder equation to solve for, I think, in my opinion. Of course, low copper can cause low iron too, but copper's interesting because...
Is it low iron or just causing to the indices to appear like it's low iron? Misinterpreting the
copper deficient anemia, which is where you don't have enough copper, causes iron deficient anemia. But it also causes iron overload in the tissue. And the reason for that is because copper is necessary for two key enzymes. The first one is called hephaestin, and the second one is called ceruloplasmin. And hephaestin is in the lining of the gut, intestinal lining, and copper is necessary for iron to be absorbed in the gut lining. So without copper, you will not absorb iron and you will develop iron deficient anemia. Now, once iron has been absorbed in the gut lining by hephaestin, it passes it off to ceruloplasmin, which is the second copper-rich enzyme. And ceruloplasmin basically then allows that copper to hop on to transferrin and then move throughout the body. So without ceruloplasmin, iron gets stuck in the tissues. It'll get stuck in the digestive system. It'll get stuck in the retina. It'll get stuck in the brain. It'll get stuck in the liver. And so you develop iron overload in the tissues. But eventually, if you're low enough in copper long enough, you might then become low in iron, and then you don't end up with all this extra iron in the tissues. And the solution is take copper to fix that problem. That's the way you solve copper deficient anemia. Now, how copper deficient anemia looks on labs is it looks very similar to iron deficient anemia. If you're looking at the iron panel, like you'll have a high TIBC, high UIBC, low serum iron, low iron saturation, low ferritin. You'll also potentially see low neutrophils and low white blood cells. Because you need copper to have normal immune function as well. So you might be more at risk for infections. And then, of course, you can look at ceruloplasmin. I don't find ceruloplasmin to be the easiest lab to look at because it's an inflammatory marker as well as ferritin. And so, but ceruloplasmin, I think, can kind of jump around. If you're taking hormones like estrogen or birth control, or you're pregnant, or you're just inflamed, or have an infection, you know, ceruloplasmin can jump around and go high. If you have a low or low normal ceruloplasmin and then you take copper and that ceruloplasmin goes up, that's a good sign that you didn't have enough copper and you needed that copper to increase your ceruloplasmin. I find serum copper to be a hard lab as well because it's kind of like all over the place and I don't think it's very accurate. I think a red blood cell copper is more accurate, but that for some reason is not available at all of the lab companies that we know, love, and use. It's not that it's impossible to order. It's just at some point in time, people get lab fatigue and they're like, just let me just do this. And so I don't tend to order as much of the red blood cell copper because I have to go to another lab. It's another expensive test. You know, it's just, I tend to, with copper deficient issues, if I see somebody that their iron's not coming up like I'd like it to, they have some of those lab findings I just talked about, you know, let's just try copper and see how you feel. But it's really important to make sure they have a healthy gallbladder, bile, liver, because if typically people don't become high in copper, unlike iron, because the body has a way to excrete excess copper through the bile. Whereas with iron, the only way to really lose the extra iron is through blood loss. So if somebody has a bile issue, they're not making enough bile, they have an unhealthy gallbladder, liver, whatever, you got to be a little bit more careful about just throwing some copper at them, because then that could get stuck in the liver and then really create a lot of damage in the liver. But, and then there are some rare genetic issues like Wilson's and Menkes that can cause a copper issue.
So are you
as well.
Taking copper personally?
Yeah.
How much do you take and what type?
Oh, am I taking copper?
Yeah.
I take copper sometimes. I'll sometimes take, I think, 2 milligrams of copper glycinate.
Or bisglycinate?
Yeah. I don't always take it because I get a lot of copper in my diet. And
like oysters or?
Oysters, I like chocolate, you know. I like cherries. I like all sorts of things that have copper in them. So I'll take it sometimes. But it's not something that – iron and copper are two things that I'm never like willy-nilly about. Mm-hmm. It's always guided by the labs as far as like – I'm not just going to say, take this, just keep taking it, you know.
Right.
There are some things that, you know, glutathione, just keep taking it. You're fine. Whereas with iron and copper, you know, we need to be getting some labs to make sure we're not creating any problems unintentionally.
Okay. So that's good advice. So how do you differentiate between someone who, I mean, more of his contention is that there is no such thing as iron deficiency. I mean, I really think that's what he believes. I mean, from my previous discussions with him, and it's almost always copper deficiency. So if you address the copper, the iron deficiency should result.
Oh, the reason I don't think that's true is because I've tried giving women copper without iron, and it doesn't fix their iron deficient anemia.
Then you tried it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Without the iron.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the things that I see the biggest problem is unaddressed GI issues. Not enough hydrochloric acid, unhealthy gut, you know, gut issues, I think are among the most common. And then heavy periods for women, it's just really hard to have that much blood loss every month for decades and have children and which are like also, you know, siphoning off iron. It is really hard to lose that much iron through your blood every month and not become anemic. And yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, it's to me as a female that has been low in iron and dealt with a lot of people with low iron, I'm just, you're never going to convince me that iron deficient anemia doesn't exist. I think there's a lot of mistreated and mismanaged.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I want to have you on because, you know, we needed a different perspective on it that wasn't as, you know, focuses morally wise. So, but I'm wondering, well, first of all, there's two questions, then I'm sure I'll have more. But the first one is, what is the ideal type of iron supplement? It would seem to me that it's not a supplement. It's red blood cells from an animal. So meat typically, but you could theoretically have blood too. Cause interestingly, yeah. I do my self phlebotomies and, I just got a puppy, so it was 4 months old, so essentially is a child, and they need iron. They have extra iron needs because they're growing, right? So I don't throw my blood away. I just give it to my puppy. They love it. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I've never tried that, yeah. But I also
I wouldn't do it to an adult dog for sure. I'd probably stop it in a few months, I would think. You know, there's a time in your life when you need extra iron for sure. So, and for certainly that's for people who have been properly diagnosed as truly iron deficient. So what, and there are many people who are strong aversions to eating any animal products. I don't think it's a wise choice, but that's their choice. So obviously you have recommendations for those too.
Yeah. So typically any patient I've seen that is, you know, vegan, vegetarian, they tend to develop low iron issues just because they're not getting enough in their diet. And I think it is hard to sometimes supplement your way out of low iron if you're not getting any through your diet. I agree with you that the best way to get iron is through your diet. You know, shellfish, beef, these are iron-rich foods with highly absorbable iron. So that's really the key, because there's two types of iron. There's heme iron and then there's non-heme iron. And heme iron is what you get in animal products. Non-heme iron is when you eat spinach and quote unquote iron-rich vegetables, that is 100% non-heme iron, which is not very absorbable. So you're going to absorb a fraction of what you would otherwise absorb of whatever iron you're consuming. So if you're not eating red meat, you know, iron-rich foods, then you're more likely to get low in iron if, you know, that is something that you struggle with. If you struggle with being high in iron, you know, maybe you don't want to eat as many of those things, or maybe you just want to remove blood and supplement accordingly so that you continue to eat those things. And I think, you know, there's a case to be made there in a world where there's fewer and fewer healthy options to, you know, fight for the healthy ones that you can eat. So I agree with you. Iron-rich foods are the best source of iron. Having said that, you know, when you're as a female especially, or like a maybe even a male that has a bad GI bleed or lost a lot of blood during a surgery, you know, if they need to come up quickly, but especially as a female, because we are fighting this constant tide. For men, they usually don't have these constant tides of iron loss like us. So females often do end up needing to take supplemental form of iron to help them overcome that loss of iron. And the form that I like, if I'm going to go to a supplement, is ferrous peptonate, which I found to be the gentlest on my gut, but also get the iron levels up. I really don't like ferrous sulfate, which is the most common given iron. Most doctors are recommending ferrous sulfate. I'm not a big fan. I don't think it works very well, and it tends to create a lot of stomach pain. So, like for me, I always have to take my iron with food, and sometimes I'll add copper or vitamin C or whatever to it. But if I don't take it with food, it's really going to upset my stomach. And then there's other forms that it doesn't matter if I take them with food, they're just going to upset my stomach too. And so nobody likes that.
Well, I'm curious, when did your husband first come down with his Cushing's? Because Cushing's, let me just first mention, the Cushing's disease is very rare. Cushing's syndrome is actually quite common because of inappropriate use of steroids. But that's not the disease. I've seen it once in my career. Most physicians don't see it at all because it's so rare. But when did he first get it?
That's okay. So I met my husband about 13 years ago, and the first time I saw him with his shirt off, I said, "You have Cushing's," because wow. he had these striae, and he didn't have like a really big belly. He had a little bit of a belly, but he said, "No, those are stretch marks from when I gained all this weight during college, and then I lost the weight." And I was in chiropractic school at the time, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, I'm such a bad diagnostician. I can't believe I just that's so embarrassing."
Right. Yeah. So you early diagnosed it.
Yeah, and then I was like, "Oh, I'm a stupid chiropractic student."
No. You were guided.
Well, it's funny because when he finally did get diagnosed, he was like, "You should have stuck with your gut feeling that first time you saw me."
That's a great illustration. You were spot on because you listened to yourself. You trusted yourself.
But I did do labs and I thought, oh, he just has this stressful career and his cortisol is high because of stress. And it was so confusing because he would go like slightly high and then he would come back down to normal and go slightly high and come back. So you would think he would be like always high, but that wasn't what, and his hemoglobin A1C was like in the fours. He's never had a high. He's very atypical. But when did he actually develop Cushing's? I think he developed Cushing's in college.
Yeah, probably. So did he have any unusual dietary behaviors? Like was he keto or carnivore or something odd?
He was disgusting.
Normal diet.
College student, you know, diet sodas.
Okay, so he wasn't any exception. It was just the sad diet, standard American diet.
It was just bad. And but during college, he had, this is an interesting story. During college, he went through this huge anxiety attack, and he had to drop out of college. And he gained all of this weight, and he had this huge anxiety attack, which I think was when the tumor really started growing. And then he went home because he had to drop out of college and kind of start all over. And he went home, and the psychiatrist, you know, gave him all these medications for the anxiety and never, you know, looked into why he might have gained all this weight and had all this anxiety. I guess they just figured college student gaining weight, having anxiety, that's not that abnormal, I guess. So then it wasn't until, and then he lost the weight, and then as we started dating, he got healthier and lost more weight. But then it wasn't until years after, you know, we got married and we kind of figured out this hemochromatosis thing, that we finally were looped in to figure out the Cushing thing. And the interesting thing is that the doctors always were like, you caught this so early, he's so mild, but it's like, he's had this for like,
It's classic.
Forever. He's had this forever. It's just, they never diagnosed it because you don't diagnose things you're not looking for.
What, do you like my opinion of what caused it?
What was that?
No, I think it was caused. The tumor, the Cushing's, you know, what I believe caused it? It was a combination.
Yes.
It was his diet, which is high in linoleic acid, very high, exceptional. Probably it was extraordinarily high because he had a poor diet, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
That in combination with the hemochromatosis and maybe some other unidentified variants. The combination that did it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. 100%.
That's what caused it.
I agree.
And it's impressive that you were able to pick it off. That is very impressive.
Well, iron likes, has a particular affinity for the anterior pituitary gland.
Oh, so, I did not know that.
Yeah. So most people.
Is that where the adenomas in the anterior pituitary gland?
Yeah. For some reason, it doesn't damage the posterior pituitary gland as much, but the adenoma, the ACTH secreting tumor, was in the anterior pituitary gland, and it was very small, but they don't have to be big to secrete a lot of hormones. And so for a lot of people, high iron will shut down their pituitary gland and they will develop hormonal problems. I think for him, he just had so much oxidative stress in there that you know, some bad cells went wild, and you know, here we are years later.
As a clinician, I think you've contributed to the literature, because I would offer that those who were responsible for assessing the management of Cushing's disease, and even syndrome to a certain extent, but certainly the disease, as part of the management, they need to look at this. They need to be aggressively sensitive to this Cushing syndrome for those with hemochromatosis. I'm sorry, not for the, but though anyone with hemochromatosis, if they're eating a bad diet, they have got to be aware that Cushing's is a possibility, because your husband is not an anomaly. And I suspect there are many others out there who have this and are just undiagnosed.
Yes, I agree. And I've brought it up with his doctors and they quickly dismissed me, but I'm used to that at this point in my life.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. It takes great courage and bravery to go forward and be dismissed by supposed experts, which is such a great illustration of, you know, having the courage and to really act on your beliefs and trust yourself in spite of what the experts are saying. It's a real, you're leading by example. And, you know, I really admire your courage to do that.
I appreciate it. I just don't have a lot of confidence in the alternative, so I just have to keep figuring it out.
Yes, because you're trusting yourself, and the lack of confidence is warranted 100%. It's 100% warranted, because they, for the most part, they don't know what they're doing. It's not that they're stupid or foolish or ignorant or willfully in some type of conspiracy at all. It's they've been brainwashed and propagandized by a system that was literally over 100 years ago designed to do precisely this. Mm-hmm. To hoodwink the entire medical system, and they've done it very effectively. And
yes.
It's going to change. I'm going to tell you, it's going to change. I've got a plan.
I hope so.
Yeah, it will. It will change, because on this current the current trajectory, they're about to destroy everything.
It going through my husband's surgeries and all of, you know, really, we were really thrown into the medical system. We couldn't get out of it because he had to have these surgeries. And it was there deep in the throes of the medical system that I realized like how it's not until you're really looking at it straight, you know, straight in the eyes that you're like, oh my gosh, this is so, so broken.
Let me offer you another suggestion, because you're obviously, this is your passion now, and you're going to see a lot of people with hemochromatosis and you're sensitive to the Cushing's, but I suggest that there's another way than surgery. I'm pretty confident you could treat it without surgery. Would you like to know how?
Yes, I would love to know how.
Okay, you need to do a cortisol blocker, a natural cortisol blocker. You know what the best cortisol blocker on the planet is? Natural progesterone.
Oh, that's so smart.
Of course. Well, I'm a pretty smart guy.
That's so smart.
Yeah, so if you had done it, now he would need a high dose, and he would need it. Normal dose is 25 to 50 milligrams. I would have put him on 300 milligrams for sure and watch the cortisol drop. And maybe if you could figure out when he was pulsing, then it would be high and was lower in normal times. But it's almost impossible to overdose on progesterone. There's like no side of the downsides. If you do it the right way, almost all the progesterone is administered incorrectly. The guy who figured it out was Ray Pete. And you just have to, because you don't want to use a cream at all. You certainly don't want to swallow a pill. That's a disaster. And I wouldn't even do a rectal suppository or vaginal suppository. The way to do it is you get vitamin E, a very specific type. 95% of vitamin E isn't that good. The kind we have is like almost perfect, but there are others. Just go to our site, look at the label, and if you find something with that ratios and stuff, that's what you need. And you take progesterone. You can buy it, USP progesterone. Pharmaceutical grade progesterone, the real deal. You can get a year's supply for under $50. It's cheap, right? And you put like, you measure it out, like a 32nd of a teaspoon is, that'd be 50 milligrams. No, I think it is. Yeah, 64th is 25 milligrams. So you get and you just put it in, you prick open the capsule of the vitamin E, put it in a, most all women need this, by the way, too. So this is not just for this odd condition of, relatively rare artifact of hemochromatosis. But you put that vitamin E in there, and you measure out the progesterone, you put it in the tablespoon, and then you mix it with a paperclip, until there's no white powder, and then you just put it on your gums, and that will get the progesterone in your system. And if you go to 50 milligrams, it's actually almost like a anesthetic, a local anesthetic, so you'll feel a little numb on your gums with the progesterone.
So if I have already like a compounded pill with 100 milligrams, can I just mix that with
100%
vitamin E?
That compounded pill is USP progesterone. It's pharmaceutical grade. So you just take half of that for 50 or a quarter for 25 milligrams. But put it in the vitamin E. Don't swallow that pill. Do not swallow that pill. Put it in the vitamin E, mix it up, because vitamin E is really the only natural chemical we know that dissolves it completely.
Okay.
You're going to get metabolic vibe. You're not going to get the progesterone you think. You need to take really high levels to get it, but that is not the way to take the progesterone.
Yeah.
And I would take it, if you're going to take it once, the best time to take it is like if you're just taking one dose and you're not treating Cushing's disease, I would take it like an hour before you go to bed, because it actually is a GABA agonist, so it'll help you sleep better too. You'll sleep much better with progesterone. And I will send you a book. I think I've got your email. I think I did. Didn't I? I'll send you one of Ray Pete's books that he wrote. It's out of print now. I think it's like $500 if you were to buy it on Amazon.
Oh,
but
wow.
It is the best health book I've ever read.
Is he the formulator of the Progest E supplement?
Yeah, that's his.
Oh, I love that stuff. It's just not strong enough.
Yeah, well, you can make it yourself. You don't need it.
It's actually, I never thought about that.
I don't like the Progest E, even though I hate to say that, because his wife is a dear woman. I hope to meet her soon. And he was the greatest health educator of the 20th century, no question. So I hope to support her in some way, but I think there's better products. He was brilliant, and it was a good idea, but it needed to be improved and refined.
Yeah, it's not strong enough.
Yeah, and you can't really measure it,
Yeah.
It's so thick. It's a lot of problems with it, but it's the right formula for sure. But if you do this way and just put in vitamin E, you can put in whatever you want. You can put 50 or 100, and you can play with it. And you'll figure it out because you're smart.
You're so right about the blocking.
You're guided too.
Well, can I tell you a story real fast? Do you have time?
Sure, of course. Yeah.
My after the first surgery where they went in and they removed part but not all of the tumor, they were like, okay, it came back, and we can put you in a study here at UT Southwestern, and you know, here are your options. We have this study where you can take this. Maybe you might get a placebo, or you might get this medication that's been shown to shrink these tumors, and it's a cortisol blocker, and it's been shown to shrink the tumors. And they had just started this study like a couple of years ago. So what I asked was, I said, well, when he is done with this study, what happens if he gets this drug that blocks the pituitary, blocks the tumor, and then he gets off of it? Does it come back? Does the tumor come back? And they said, at UT Southwestern, they said, well, we stopped looking at them after they're done with the study. They don't even know the side effects. And then it turns out it does grow back. Now, years later, we know that. So, but then they said, okay, well, because my husband didn't want to have another surgery. The first surgery was very painful because the surgeon messed up. But then we did this trial of this medication that was, I think it was called Isturisis, and that was a cortisol blocker. And that drug started out at $60,000 a month. And then by the time we were done, and like they kept raising the price because insurance kept paying more. And by the time we were done and he had the surgery, they were charging insurance $150,000 a month for this drug.
No way, you out of here. Really?
Yeah, yeah. And okay. So he
was
on.
That would buy 10 lifetimes of progesterone, maybe 100 lifetimes of progesterone.
Yeah, yeah. He was on 50 milligrams a day, and they stopped selling the 10 milligram pills. So he had to start taking twice as many 5 milligram pills. And that's when the price doubled.
And $300,000 a month. Almost $4 million a year. You just described the classic perfect medical model to fail to avoid ever coming close to treating the cause of the disease,
right,
and coming up with a hyper expensive solution that doesn't work long term, just as a Band-Aid.
And it had side effects.
It can kill you. Right.
Yeah. That's the
classic medical model.
Yeah. And after my husband had surgery and he didn't need the drug anymore, the pharmaceutical rep called his endocrinologist and asked if they were going to put him back on it.
Of course. Yeah. Because I guarantee you that rep got a percentage of that. There's a lot. Yeah. $4 million a year or $300,000 a month. If he gets 5%, you know, that's a big part of his paycheck.
Oh, yeah. So I thought you'd find that story interesting.
Yeah, but the take home point here is natural progesterone. It is literally a miracle. Though eventually we're going to be offering some type of simpler solution, so you don't have to do that little apothecary thing in your kitchen. But it works, and it only takes a moment. I do it every night myself because we haven't made the product yet. So, but that is probably the finest way. It's the freshest. It's totally fresh. You dissolve it in real time, and you put it in your gums. It's like you couldn't get it any fresher.
Yeah,
and it's,
I'm going to do it.
As I said, it's on Amazon. USP progesterone. You type it in. 10 grams is $40, I think.
Oh wow.
And that's almost a year's worth of treatment for
wow. 40,
you know, and then you got the. I'll send you the book, and you will delight. And I predict that you will have a new passion,
because
that is just the tip of the iceberg. But it is a very potent cortisol. It's actually an adrenaline blocker too. So if you have stress, you can take that. And you'll chill out. Boom. It's a very powerful. It's an anti-stress hormone.
Yeah.
Cortisol, glucagon, and adrenaline.
I wish I had known that years ago. I would have been doing that with my husband years ago.
I just
didn't know. So now, thank you for that.
You're welcome. And it's likely he would still continue to benefit from it. I would check his prolactin level because
there has been a time in the past where it was high. I don't think they've checked it since surgery.
I would check it because it should be well under 10. If he's over 10, you know, it should be close to 6 or even 5. And the progesterone will not drop that because that's estrogen.
Oh,
because
wow.
There's two things that cause cancer. No, there's not a microdoubt in my mind. It's linoleic acid excess omega-6 and estrogen.
Yes.
Yeah, those are the two things. They have similar mechanisms, actually. They both cause water retention.
And the estrogen causes the high prolactin?
Yes. That is, you know, measuring estrogen is really challenging because it's mostly in the tissues. And you could have, like, a postmenopausal woman that might come back at zero, but she might be hyperestrogenic because it's in her tissues. It's not in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So the best marker I found is prolactin. It's the cheap, because you got to, there's three different estrogens you have to measure. And there's probably dozens of other that may be clinically seen. We don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it would cost hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars to measure them all. But prolactin is relatively inexpensive, and it's one test.
And you want it to be less than 6?
Less than 6. Certainly less than 10. But if it's like 15, 20 or higher, you got to lower that, because that it only goes up with estrogen.
Wow, that's good to know.
Yeah, you should check it yourself too.
I will.
Prolactin, yeah. Yeah, I just learned that within the last year or so. But as soon as I've been playing with progesterone, because mine was high, I put one in the progesterone, boom, drop, boom, down to 6.
That's awesome. Yeah. No, I just started taking progesterone, so I'm glad we had this conversation, because now I'm going to refine what I'm doing.
Yeah, yeah. And now you know the best way to take the progesterone.
Yes, I didn't understand that before.
It's an important thing, and mm-hmm. Your eyes will be open when you get this book. I will send it to you as soon as we finish.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I will read it from cover to cover.
Well, you're an anomaly. You should have went to med school. I don't know why. I'm not to disparage chiropractors, but the medical profession needs brilliance like yours, because you're so handicapped without that medical license, you know?
I know.
And it sucks, because you would have been. We need more people like you. There's so much wackiness out there to be combated. You know, even with a degree, it's going to be hard. You know, if you had a job with a clinic, they would have fired you because you wouldn't have taken the jab for sure. You know, but so in some ways, it's good you have your own business, so you're kind of insulated from the craziness. But
it was
a
chiropractor that helped me, so that's why I became a chiropractor.
Oh, I know. Yeah, but you're doing a great job, and I really appreciate your diligence on this and your fortitude and helping people understand this, and, you know, doing a lot of good, and helping me understand too that, you know, I kind of thought that a little bit morally was off, and it just didn't seem right that many people, that there had to be. But here's another point for you to consider, that I don't believe your statement. What you stated was what is, you'll find many references for that statement, that iron is the most common nutritional deficiency. I don't think it is, because you have a whole population that where iron is high. And I think there may be even more people where it's high than low. And then you've got the whole population, which you know, because you're nutritionally oriented, that magnesium is like 80% of the population is deficient in magnesium. So, I mean, in my book, magnesium exceeds iron deficiency by far. And maybe even zinc, too.
Yeah.
And maybe even copper. Because the iron was stated because that's what they know. And I think that is in the literature out of ignorance, not because of truth.
Yeah.
That's my speculation.
And also because they're looking for it.
Yeah. And who's looking for magnesium deficiency? No one.
Right.
Yet the people who have know. That is almost everyone needs to be on magnesium. Almost everyone. I haven't found a person yet that is on magnesium replete.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so safe because it's got a self-protective mechanism. If you get too much, you have loose stools and you excrete it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to overdose of magnesium.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you take an IV. Unless you take an IV, you could potentially. But that would be the only case.
Go to the chapter in the Iron Curse, page mm-hmm. whatever, 272.
Put your book up so people can see it. Yeah.
Go to page 272 and look at the chart of all the supplements and how they lower and affect iron, and play around with some of those to see if you can.
I think I really appreciate it. You know, I wasn't particularly looking for personal recommendations, but it makes perfect sense that you did curcumin and or quercetin. When I don't eat much meat, I eat maybe 3 ounces a day, but I could easily essentially bind up all that iron in there, because it is a concern. I think that's why I might continue to climb. And I don't eat too much iron otherwise. I mean, I have very little iron in my diet other than the meat. And it's 3 ounces is not a lot of meat.
Oh. I thought you ate more.
No, I used to, but not much. No, just 3 ounces a day. That's it. My dog eats a lot more. My dog eats a pound of meat. He's
Lucky
a carnivore.
dog.
I'm not.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thank you for what you're doing. You keep up the good work, and I'll send you Ray Pete's book.
Okay.
All right. Okay.